Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined once again by Mr. Michael Morrison. Michael, thank you so much for being on the podcast again this week. You helped me out of a situation, so thank you very much for being on.
Pleasure.
Let's get into the news of today. The first thing we're going to be talking about is something produced by one of our colleagues at the Center for Risk Analysis, Gerbrand van Heerden, who's been on the podcast before, talking about the quality of life in the various provinces around the country and the contrasts about what differences. The point for me about all this is the difference that policy makes to the lives of ordinary people. So he starts off in this piece on the Daily Friend by talking about the differences in the latest unemployment statistics. The country's expanded unemployment rate remains at 42.1%, which is only a very marginal decline from the previous quarter's 42.4%. This is the most, the last quarter of 2025. Gauteng and KZN both lost jobs in that jobs report in the last quarter of 2025. Gauteng shed 54,000 and KwaZulu-Natal shed 41,000. These provinces are home to just under half of the South African population, so that's obviously a big deal. In contrast, the Western Cape reached the lowest unemployment rate, with its expanded unemployment definition being 23.7%, and it added 93,000 jobs quarter on quarter in that same period, which is basically making up for the loss in Gauteng and KZN. He also talks about the Center for Risk Analysis's Quality of Life Index, which is something a product they produce, which looks at various factors about how life is for South Africans in our various provinces, giving every province a score between 0 and 10, 0 being just absolutely terrible and 10 being everything is pretty much perfect. The Western Cape, unsurprisingly, was the best performing province here with a quality of life index score 5.9 out of 10, followed by Gauteng at 5.5. The worst performing provinces were the Eastern Cape and Mpumalanga with 4.5 each. South Africa's average score was 5.1. The Western Cape's expanded unemployment rate is half of Northwest's. In Limpopo, only 10% of households spent 10,000 or more rand per month. In comparison, the Western Cape, that percentage was 40% of houses were spending 10,000 rand or more a month. Only 9.8% of households in the Western Cape experience irregular or no waste removal. This is the only province where that percentage is below 20%. A quarter of households in the Western Cape were able to afford medical aid. This was more than twice the rate in the Eastern Cape, where it's only 10%. KZN is only 10%. Limpopo, it's only 10%. Mpumalanga, it's only 10%. Western Cape also led with households having access to basic sanitation facilities. The Western Cape is also the province with the least water interruptions, despite many of its water problems that we've seen recently in the news. Only 3.8% of households in the Western Cape experienced water interruptions once a month. A couple of times a month or once a week. This is much better than some of the other provinces. In Mpumalanga, the same number was 67%. KZN was 62%. Limpopo was 54%. And Gauteng at 20%. Cape Town also had the smallest percentage of houses that experienced water interruptions for at least 48 hours. Only about 7% of households in Cape Town had to endure water interruptions that last 2 days or longer. That's still, you know, too high a number for 7%, but you compare it to the other cities in Nelson Mandela Bay, that number is 40%, 28% in Echegweni, Durban, 27% in Buffalo City, East London, 25% in Joburg, 23% in Pretoria, Tswane, and 17% at Ekurhuleni. And I'm sure since that data came in, it's probably actually worse than some of those Gauteng metros. So why are we talking about this? For me, Michael, you know, this isn't about saying, oh, big up, look, the DA is running the Western Cape so well. That's, you know, they can make that case for themselves. For me, the point here is that when you do things differently, and they don't even have to be that different, right? the powers that a government has at provincial and municipal level, they're important, but they're not that extensive. The Western Cape is still subject to the same national laws and many of the same constraints on infrastructure overall, at least on labor regulation, on, you know, like licensing in the Labor Commission, on all these things. And yet, even with those limited differences in ability to change policy, the quality of life in that province is markedly different from the rest of the country. I mean, the unemployment rate is what, about half what it is in other provinces. And I think for me, Michael, the point of that is that, you know, there's this kind of, I think, amongst many South Africans, particularly South Africans who are unhappy with the ANC, particularly with middle-class South Africans, you know, it's all kind of just a bit hopeless. Like, nothing can change. The country is just sort of in an endless crisis, and it's never going to get better, and you must just go overseas, or you must build a fortress in the woods somewhere or whatever and just hunker down because the future is bleak. I think what these stats show is that government choices really do make a big difference. What's your take on all these statistics?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. You know, that the quality of that fatalism which we see, I think, you know, across all communities in South Africa, and perhaps for good reason, because you know, we've had one sort of dominant brand of political thinking affecting our lives since 1994, more or less, and you know, a lot of people have got the sense that, you know, there's no way that we can change this. There isn't any way that we can influence it to change, and so on. So that fatalism, I think, is an important thing, and an important thing to counter. And your drawing attention to the Western Cape in this context, I think, is absolutely valid and very important. Gerbrandt, the author of the piece, Gerbrandt van Heerden, draws attention to this himself. He says, the Western Cape cannot fully escape the issues that plague broader South African society. And he mentions crime, inequality, unemployment. But he concludes by saying the Western Cape has nevertheless shown that despite a tough economic and political situation, it can improve the fundamentals, and those fundamentals are limited in some ways. You know, the Western Cape has no say over the policing. It can't really, it can influence the economy up to a point, but the national economy is really going to be the most dominant influence coming to bear on all of us in the Western Cape. And yet it can improve incrementally lots of different things: schooling, the roads, no potholes, making it easier for business, and the cumulative effect of all those sort of kind of incremental things, I think, can be enormously important. This is why I think data is very important. As an organization, the IRR since 1929, by the way, has been emphasizing this: do research, figure out what's happening, count the numbers of people doing whatever they're doing, because it really does tell a story. And it tells a story about shifts as well, how things are changing, where they're changing. And I think all that is very significant and is borne out by these things. And, you know, I think you're absolutely right to say, you know, this is not about crowing about one political party or another. There's nothing necessarily magical about the Western Cape. But the thing that I've often said is, you'll keep saying, it's not rocket science. We're not looking at things which are kind of superhuman. It's all just ordinary political management on the ground, doing things properly. And from that comes that optimism, which inspires investment. It inspires people to move to the Cape. I mean, it adds enormous stresses and strains on the city of Cape Town in particular. But that's what a thriving city is proved to be, is one that has difficulties. It's under stress because people want to be there. It's not stagnating. And I think all these things are evident in these figures that you mentioned.
And, you know, I think it's once again just sort of an indication of you know, how some of these basic things, as you say, the fundamentals, as Kerry pointed out, are sort of so important. For example, if you are wanting to build something and you put in a request to that from the city, Does a building inspector come and see your property and give you, you know, this is like, obviously the rules about what is and isn't allowed are also important, because if the rules are too strict, you can have problems. If the rules are completely non-existent, you can have problems. But just the simple ability to follow the procedure that is on paper, I think, is also very important. And, you know, while we were setting up for the show, one of the other stories we considered here was that Joburg has a shortage of building inspectors to monitor construction sites. And I know from a few years ago, I was speaking to a property developer in Johannesburg about how difficult it is to simply get any kind of legal housing approved in the city. So what happens is that either you have a stagnation because the people who want to follow the law can't get anything approved, because they either have to pay bribes, or they have to wait a very long time, or the rules are so complex that they have to hire lawyers and things to go through all of it, or people just go ahead and do whatever they want, and then, you know, you get kind of chaos, you get buildings that fall down, you get buildings that block people's views, you get developments that, you know, ruin the local environment that haven't had any kind of ability to, or any mitigation for that. And so, yeah, no, it's not a sexy story in a way, but it is just a reminder that things can be done differently and successes can be achieved. Still big problems in the Western Cape. As you've mentioned, the crime problem is a very big one, right? The Western Cape has an enormous number of murders. There are still big pockets of poverty. In other countries, if you said the unemployment rate is 23%, people would lose their minds. That would be an insane number. I remember back in the US, in the midst of the financial crisis in 2008, it was a great political scandal because during the early years of Barack Obama's presidency, the unemployment rate reached 8%. I wish South Africa could have an unemployment rate of 8%. That would be lovely. But you know, you can still make progress. Things can change and things can be done differently, even with the limited means that South Africa has at its disposal quite often. Any more thoughts on this before we move on?
Yes, indeed. I just on that very last point, you know, doing things differently. And one of the key themes of the IRR's campaigning and its argumentation over the past few years has been looking at some of the fundamental legislative processes, empowerment being a key one. BEE, we've had a number of campaigns just recently on looking at the BEE premiums that South African taxpayers are paying, running to at least 100 billion a year on government procurement spending of some 1 trillion. So it's, you know, it's these significant numbers, sums of money that are being spent. And then you look at the CRA's index, this quality of life index. I can't remember if you mentioned right at the beginning what it's essentially based on a basket of 10 items. It's to try and get a sense of the quality of life of people, or a person or a household. So it would include, for instance, on a score of 1 to 10 or 0 to 10, it would look at, for instance, people with a university or higher matric or higher qualification earning 10,000 rand a month or more, whether they've got a bonded property, whether they have access to pipe water, electricity, and so on. So it's a basket of 10 of these items. So it's quite a good measure. And so looking at how things have changed and how things haven't changed, the one thing that hasn't changed, despite all the political emphasis of the ruling party, and also, in quite honestly, much of the intelligentsia that's shifting, I think, on racial redress, is in stark contrast to the evidence that we see in this quality of life survey, which shows the scores being from the lowest to the highest. For Black South Africans, 4.8, colored South Africans, 5.7, Indian Asian South Africans, 6.6, and white, 7.3. So this is stubbornly a stubbornly resistant pattern, which is no surprise to the IRR, because we've kept warning about it. We've kept saying empowerment is absolutely necessary. It's got to be done, but you can do it without resorting to race. By using race, you're opening the door to all kinds of manipulation and exploitation, which we do not need, and you are failing to address the actual need. So these figures bear this out very, very broadly, and it's important to keep reminding people this is why we make the arguments we do. It's certainly not good for the economy that we have all these impingements, but it's absolutely not good at all for people who desperately need the empowerment, the help, the skills, and so on. So that's just right. Another element.
It's a reminder that so many of these sort of race-based policies or supposedly pro-poor policies, I think, pushed by the ANC and their sort of ideological fellow travelers in the UFF and MK, have not actually helped the people that they were very specifically designed to help, which is the majority of Black South Africans.
Yeah. And this goes all the way back to 1998, you know, in case we forget. It's been a long time. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, indeed. Okay, let's move on to our next story. And this is remembering a South African politician who, you know, both of us were quite fond of. He passed, I think it was today, and that is Masiwa Lekota, the leader, or I think he was, I think he may have recently stepped down of the Congress of the People Party. Masiwa Lekota also went by the nickname Terror, because apparently he was an absolute terror on the soccer field. He was born in Kroonstad in the Free State, and he earned his nickname of Terror Lekota as a fearsome attacking player. He matriculated from St. Francis College in Durban before he enrolling for a social science degree at the University of the North, but he was expelled in 1972 due to being part of South African Students' Organization, SASO, sort of anti-apartheid activism there. In 1974, he was imprisoned for conspiring to commit acts endangering the maintenance of law and order, relating to that anti-apartheid activism. He was released in 1982. He was elected into a position in the United Democratic Front in 1983. And in 1985, he was one of 11 anti-apartheid activists found guilty in the Delmas treason trial, and was, you know, once again imprisoned. He was released in 1989. He then went into the ANC and he served in various capacities before being appointed Premier of the Free State in 1994, and he held that position until 1996. But he spent most of his time as Premier in the Free State fighting with another famous figure of South African politics from the Free State, being Ace Magashule, who ultimately would triumph in that internal ANC battle. Lekota was appointed national chairperson of the ANC in December of 1997, and he held that position for 10 years until 2007, when he was succeeded by Baleka Mbete. He, of course, famously was one of the ministers. He was the Minister of Defense from the 90s, I think, until 2008, 2009, somewhere around there, who, when Thabo Mbeki was removed as president by the ANC, resigned to go and form the Congress of the People Party, which at the time some wondered whether it could indeed overthrow the ANC in the next election, the 2009 election. Things didn't turn out like that, and there are perhaps reasons we can talk about that COPE never really flew. However, Cope still got 7% in that next election, and it looked like it was set to be one of the big parties in South Africa. That didn't really come to pass, however, though. The party fell into infighting. He fought a very long internal battle with Mzima Shaloa, who was his sort of co-conspirator in that party, and the party would disintegrate over subsequent elections, remaining sort of roughly in parliament, I think, until 2024. But pretty much falling away from the national conversation. However, that didn't stop him from still making a name for himself on the national stage. In 2018, he took part in the debate on expropriation of property and land, He was very opposed to constitutional amendments that would take away the right damage the right to property, rather. He was very critical of the EFF and particularly their racially charged rhetoric, saying of the EFF that Julius Malema was pushing the country towards a war over land. He said, quote, "Those who don't know about war, peacetime heroes know nothing about war. Why is war a virtue today when generations of mankind saw all the world wars? Does Malema even know what a genocide is? It's horrible. I'm quite convinced if South Africans allow for a majority of people in parliament to say, let's take land without compensation, then black, white, and Indian people will die," he said. He said that it was important for property and land redistribution to be properly managed, and that people shouldn't simply be given agricultural land without any knowledge or support to be able to farm it. He also was prone in his life to sort of doing slightly odd things. During this period, he also at one point accused Cyril Ramaphosa of selling out anti-apartheid activists, including himself, to the apartheid regime during the struggle, something which he then never really kind of supported with much evidence, and later kind of walked back. In the lead-up to the 2009 election, he was asked if HIV caused AIDS, and he said, "Look, I'm not an expert on HIV and AIDS. I don't want to venture an opinion about whether it does or does not. I'm not a medical doctor," which seems like he was still sort of essentially echoing support for the position of his ally Thabo Mbeki on his view on AIDS. There was also that very bizarre episode when he was Minister of Defence, when the government raided the Military History Museum in Johannesburg, claiming that the old, mostly deactivated equipment there could be used to level Soweto within minutes, was, I believe, the quote from that news story, so, which is a very hard thing. I'm not sure how involved he was in that raid, but it happened while he was Minister of Defense, so I'm sure he at least has some knowledge of it if he wasn't directly involved. He was prone, I think, sometimes to saying slightly odd things, but, you know, for me, Michael, he was a good man. He was ultimately a non-racialist, and he was someone who I think really did care about his country and fought passionately for what he believed in. He wasn't cowed by the environment, about what was hip. I think he stood up for what he believed in, and his passing is a loss for the country, I think. I don't know, do you agree? What do you have to say about the life of Mr. Lokota?
Yes, I think your assessment is right. You almost think of him as being a sort of unlikely or not obvious politician, that history sort of foisted this role on him. As I think happened to a number of people who, you know, perhaps participating in civil activity, civil society activity, political activity in the UDF and the underground and all the rest of it, that's not a qualification for being an effective politician. And some of them turned out to be, you know, quite effective, but it isn't a good preparation for the job or you know, a recommendation for the job. And there's a sense of that with Terry Lokota. His name, you know, I remember talking to people in the 80s, late 80s and the 90s, and people would often latch onto the idea that terror came from his, you know, involvement with terrorism. I think we're often surprised, you know, as we grew to know the man, we're surprised when they met him. He was this fairly gentle fellow who I think, and I'm going to mention something that he said in Parliament in 2004, but I think he was able, as you said, to sort of look beyond the ideological fixities and shibboleths and see just an ordinary South Africanness, which I think he enjoyed seeing. I think he relished being part of that. I can't really remember a great deal of his tenure as Premier of the Free State, but I do remember, you know, talking to people that I know in the Free State, and they're having a sense of this chap who, you know, he was very accessible. Loved the place. He loved the fresh start. You know, the whole sort of geographical identity of what it means to be a Free Stater. And I think he possessed some of that, quite sort of Mandela-esque, I suppose, in a way. But the thing that I thought was really very significant was, I remember writing about it years later, but in 2004, he was then the Minister of Defence. And actually, funny enough, at the same time, also the national chairperson of the ANC. And he said in Parliament, and these are his actual words, "When will we cease to be Africans, coloureds, Indians and whites and merely be South Africans? This is the question we must ask ourselves." Now, there were a lot of people who thought that this was absolutely outrageous, you know, that we needed to cleave to these divisive definitions because that's the only way that you could get over them. You had to, you know, identify people by their race in order to get over the race, which quite a number of significant people on the left at that point were rejecting. Neville Alexander was another, a very forceful opponent. But nevertheless, for somebody who, you know, the national chairperson of the ANC, and this just, 6 years after the first equity legislation had been passed, this is quite a significant thing. And he made a point in an interview around about that time where he said, you know, we cannot keep them forever, the race-based affirmative action measures, but we cannot keep them forever and allow ourselves to be accused of practicing that which we fought against. And that's not a view that you hear very often these days from anyone in the sort of ruling establishment or indeed the new BEE sponsored those elements of the middle class. I think the middle class is much bigger than just the BEE crowd, but the BEE defenders, you'd never hear them admitting that there might be some reason to be anxious about continuing to use race. So very significant, you know, for him to have said those things as a minister and as a chairperson of the ANC all the way back in 2004, just 10 years after the ANC had come to power. Yeah. So an interesting man.
Indeed. And in the lead up to the 2009 election, Cope began to lose momentum, I think, actually before the election ever took place. There were some defections back to the ANC of people who had joined Cope. And there was some speculation that he would be one of them. And so he was asked by a journalist, you know, whether he was planning on defecting back to the ANC. And he said, "There's no way I can return to the company of men and women who are dead set on destroying the constitutional democracy, which I gave most of my life to creating. I will go to the grave a member of the Congress of the People." And indeed, so he did. And with that, let's move on to our last story very briefly. This one, it made me draw my eyes so hard that I think they kind of went into the back of my head and I had to pull them back out again. This is an opinion piece written by two groups, the Assembly of the Unemployed and the Cry of the Excluded, which was published in the Daily Maverick. And its title sort of sounds all right at first. "South Africa's jobs crisis will not be solved by dialogue for the elite." That's a sentiment I can get on board with. The subheading, though, goes on to talk about the dangers of market fundamentalism. And let me quote a little bit from this opinion piece. "On the 23rd to 25th of February, beneath the vaulted ceilings of St. George's Cathedral, grassroots organizations from across the country will gather for a People's Assembly on Unemployment, Austerity, and the Fight for Decent Work, convened by the Assembly of the Unemployed and Cry of the Excluded. This meeting comes on the eve of yet another anti-poor, pro-capitalist budget, one that is likely to deepen austerity in a country already buckling under crisis." They go on to talk about essentially how business is all responsible for unemployment, that labor regulations aren't really enforced, that it's all just lax, that these are myths, and that there are millions of people without qualifications who cannot find work. Young graduates join the ranks of the unemployed alongside those with incomplete schooling. Wages for the majority remain poverty level. Labor protections are weakly enforced. The problem is not the workers cost too much. It is that the economy is built on financialization, extraction, and crony capitalism. Trade and financial liberalization have decimated the local industry. Privatization and outsourcing strip the state of capacity to drive development. Austerity budgets have cut public employment and reduced social spending precisely when it is most needed. Now, I could go on, and the piece does go on at length, but Michael, it's really frustrating because, you know, some of the problems with the country are indeed correctly identified here. They are very right to highlight how terrible the unemployment crisis is. They are correct to point to a kind of crony capitalism that indeed does exist, where a sort of politically connected big businesses have cozy relationships with the state, or sometimes not always big businesses, sometimes small, cozy connected businesses run by politically aligned cadres get benefits from the state. But the problem is not privatization, something that has by and large been, you know, cast aside by the state in this country in so many ways. It's not a so-called austerity budget after years of running us more and more into debt, really reaching the limits of how much the state could tax without killing the economy, you know, pushing us increasingly towards a kind of fiscal devastation, one that has only very recently begun to reverse itself. These guys, unfortunately, I think, are completely out of touch with the situation in this country. Your thoughts on this piece?
Yeah, it's a shame. You know, the sort of ideological straitjacketing that you see here that really just, you know, foreshortens any opportunity to engage, to sort of really begin to think about, you know, what is it that creates economic activity? What is it that produces jobs? What is it that makes life better for a country? You can't even get anywhere near these very fundamental questions because they've got all this stuff in the way, and it's all ideological. It's kind of binary thinking. It's almost resisting engagement rather than reaching out and saying, you know, we've got such important problems, and we do. Can we not sit down and you know, thrash out, you know, what the real issues are? What do we really need to be focusing on? And it is just a shame. I just happened to notice, I looked up at the Unemployed Assembly's website, and the first thing that I noticed from Soweto Day in 2022 was a headline, Youth Day Statement, young people are excluded from enjoying the fruits of our democracy. Well, as it happens, nobody is excluded from enjoying the fruits of our democracy if you participate. You know, the democracy is not going to just automatically deliver the goodies if you don't get in there and, you know, exercise your rights and your opportunity to get the goodies, to make sure there are goodies in the first place. And that's really the hard slog. It's the hard slog of doing politics. It's not, there are no quick fix solutions to anything, but you've got to get in there. You can't simply say that you're excluded with a, you know, that as we were talking before the show, the way they spell excluded is X and then included, which is, you know, it's a very sort of sassy middle class sort of thing to do. To call yourself that, and you know, it just it you almost define yourself as kind of irrelevant to the real debate. There are people who are excluded, and they're people without jobs. Fundamentally, I mean, that's without jobs, without assets, without property rights. Those are the real excluded people, and the only question is, how do we make them included? And to have that serious conversation, you go to Parliament, and you get involved in the debate. You form a party and you make sure you get the votes. You get out there on the hustings. It's hard work. It takes years. And that's what you do. That's unfortunately what living in a constitutional democracy means, which is a great advance on what we had before. But we've got to use it. That's the only way we get to actually seriously tackle our problems.
Look. You know, I wouldn't be entirely, I don't think it would be completely inaccurate to call me an ideologue. And I'm sure that there are some who would describe me as a free market fundamentalist. But I still work on this show and on others too, and in other things that I write and say, and to be grounded in reality, to be grounded in the circumstances of this country. And when you get sort of ideologues like this, who, rather than tackling the ways in which essentially the country has been run, not entirely by the policies I think that these guys would advocate, but broadly along those lines, why it hasn't worked, and to just pretend like we're living in some sort of hyper-capitalist nightmare libertarian state, which is just so completely ridiculous, it demonstrates a lack of seriousness. It's sort of like just refusing to deal with, you know, where we actually are and deal with the actual problems, and just, you know, get on the soapbox and say, it's all the evil capitalist class have once again screwed over the workers. Well, you know, good luck, guys. I'm sure the EFF agrees with you. So, you know, you should probably just go and campaign for them, because I'm not sure the dialogue of the unemployed or whatever is going to actually make much of a difference to anyone's lives, unfortunately. With that, let's call this all to a close. So thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting, and we will be back tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.